It was very good to see Betty Lamb come in tonight. It's been a difficult time in her life, but we're so glad that you're here, Betty. And we didn't expect to see you, but we're glad we did. We are looking up at the Sermon on the Mount, and we're in Matthew chapter 6. And Jesus has gone from talking about prayer to talking about having an eternal perspective on life. And the way that you know you have an eternal perspective on life, he says, has to do with your possessions and how you manage your possessions. Look with me in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 through 24. He says, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." In those first three verses, verses 19 through 21, Jesus is chronicling the great assets that you could hold in the first century. If he was in our century, he might say, "Now I want to talk to you about your cash, about your real estate, and about your investments in the stock market." But here he says, let me just talk to you about, first of all, clothes. You see that. He says, don't lay up for yourself treasures that moths can destroy. And he's referencing clothes. And that day and age, clothes were as good as money in the bank. You remember when Achan robbed when they were conquering in Judges, and Achan took that which was forbidden to take, and he took a little silver, and he took a little gold, and then he took a robe. And the goal was not that he was going to particularly wear the robe, although that he might have done that, but it was a fine robe. It would have been made perhaps with silk, and it would have appreciated in value. It was a great investment, and if you had money to invest, you might invest in clothing, like you and I might perhaps invest in a Persian rug or some fine furniture. If you buy well, it actually appreciates in value. And he says, don't lay up clothing. No, that's an investment, but be careful what you do with that. And then he talks about filling your storehouses full of grain. He says, or don't lay up things that rust can destroy. The word rust there actually means eating. And depending on which translator you have, perhaps they have the image of something being eaten by rust. But I think in this passage, eating is a reference again to storehouses. I mean, if you really wanted to get very rich, one of the ways that you could get very rich is that you could build storehouses, you could store grain, and to the degree that you could hold the grain until a famine, or you could hold the grain until a subpar harvest, you could sell your grain at a very nice profit. I mean, it's about supply and demand. And if you've got it and others haven't stored up, others have not prepared for the famine as you have, others have not prepared for the harvest that you have, you can sell what you have at a pretty great markup, and it was a way to really become wealthy. But he says you ought not think about doing that. And then he talks about things like gold and silver and jewels, or things that thieves might break in and steal. And in the Greek language, break in actually means literally dig in. The walls were adobe, and they would actually dig a hole into the house. And if you had something, you might put it in the house. You would have probably buried it someplace in the house. Most of those houses were dirt floors. But he says, don't focus on those things either. So he's talking about the great assets, clothing, storing up food, storing up gold and silver and precious jewels and those sorts of things. He says, don't do that, because when you do that, it shows that you don't have an eternal perspective, because all those things decay in the end. All those things rot in the end. All of those things get destroyed in the end. They either get taken from you or you get taken from them. Now, you say, well, does that mean that we ought not have any savings? And I don't think that the Bible would say that, no, don't, you ought not save, because you have passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 12 where Paul makes a general principle. He's not talking about money in particular. If you've got that, perhaps not. Paul says something like, well, let me read it to you. Anybody know where 1 Corinthians is? No, I'm joking. New Testament. Oh, there it is. Now, for the third time, I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I do not seek yours, but you. For the children ought not lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. And he's making a principle there. He's saying, essentially, I'm your father in the faith, and fathers ought to care for their children. Fathers ought not save for their children ought not have to save for their parents, but parents ought to save for their children. But you see there that he's not denying the principle that parents ought to save for their children. You have, for instance, in Proverbs, twice in the book of Proverbs, we're told to be as wise as ants. And what do we know about ants? Ants store up. They store up for the rainy day. They know in the summer that they need to prepare for the winter. And so it just makes good sense. It makes good wisdom to say you need to save while you're working, because the day may come when you can't work anymore due to physical reasons, and you need to have something when you're no longer able to work. Really, if you think about it, the eighth commandment doesn't make any sense if you don't have possessions. Sometimes people look at Acts chapter 2 and they say, well, you know, they sold everything they had and had all things in common, which I don't think is necessarily true, because then it says they met from house to house, so they didn't obviously sell the houses. But if you think about it, the eighth commandment, which is thou shalt not steal, doesn't make any sense unless you have stuff to steal, right? So he's not saying get rid of everything. I don't think he's saying necessarily don't save, don't look to the future and be wise in your finances. But he is saying, there's a line that you cross where you've gone past the ideal of wisdom, and now you've turned into a materialist. I mean, how much do you need? And you look at the future and say, well, this is what I think that I need, and I'd like to pass something on to the children. But certainly that doesn't mean that you have to spend your life accumulating far more than you or your children could spend. And the truth of the matter is, here he says, the danger is that where your treasure is, your heart will be. And that's the danger. These things ultimately are temporary. And if you spend all your time accumulating, doing investing, focusing on the storehouses, ultimately your heart is going to be focused on the world and not to eternal things. Who was the preacher who walked through the great house and he said something to the effect, boy, when you have this much, it's hard to die. And it's true, isn't it? When you've got so much, it keeps you eternally bound. And he says, so it causes a heart problem if all you are is focused on the things that ultimately, things which can be destroyed, things that are eaten away, or things that are destroyed by the moths, or things that can be stole. He says, but see, it can distract your heart, but it can also blind your eye. He said, that's the problem with material things. It tends to pull your heart away from the eternal, but it also tends to blind your eyes to that which is valuable. You see that in verse 22 through 23. That's a hard passage, and it seems that Jesus is talking about spiritual blindness, and he is, but verses 19 and 21, he's talking about the dangers of wealth. Verse 24, he's talking about the dangers of of wealth or materialism. And so it seems strange that he would go a different path in between and just go and talk about spiritual sight in general. He's talking, I think, about what materialism does to spiritual sight. He says, the lamp of the body is the eye, and if therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? I take it that what he's saying is this. If you have good eyes, your body will be able to move without being injured. If your eyes reflect light, and isn't that why you would go blind? I mean, the reason you can't see in the dark is that there's no light to reflect. And so if your eyes are functioning properly, your eyes take in light and there is a refraction and you can see what's in front of you. If your eyes are good, you can see what's in front of you. And in that sense, your body is not blind because now your body can move around the room. If your eyes work, your body will work. But if your eyes are blind, you're going to trip over everything. Your body's going to be blind too. And so he's saying essentially that materialism or money can blind your sight, and it can cause then every other aspect of your life to be hindered because you don't see things as they really are. Materialism can blind you to the realities of life. Think about it, two or three here. What does money tend to blind you to? How does money tend to blind your sight and cause you to make disastrous decisions? One way is that money blinds you to money. I know that might not be the best way to put it, but money blinds you to how much money you have. I think we talked about that a few months ago. The problem with money is that materialism and all sin, and materialism, in particular tonight, has an addictive quality. Look at what Paul says in 1 Peter 6. First Timothy 6. Yeah, I'm all over the place. Sorry, it's not your fault, Virginia. We're friends. I'm misleading you. I'm sorry. Making it hard. Paul says, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. So having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and the many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. Now just look at that one second. He says, if you desire to be rich, it causes you to fall into temptation and a trap, and you fall into a trap which leads to many foolish and harmful lusts which ultimately lead to destruction. Now, what is he talking about right there? That's the language of addiction. He said, you desire something, and out of that desire, you get trapped, you get into a snare, and the snare causes you to be destroyed. That's addiction. That's what's true of every addiction. There's something you desire, but the thing you desire traps you, and in the trap, it destroys you. That's what happens with drugs. That's what happens to sexual addiction. That's what happens to everything. Desire leads to entrapment, and the entrapment leads to destruction. Now, he's saying that's what happens if you desire to be rich. And here's the thing. Money deceives you to how much money you have. The first trait of addiction is denial about the addiction. I mean, the first thing you're blind to if you're addicted is that you're addicted. It's denial. I mean, everybody knows every 12 step is the first thing is you have to admit that you have a problem because you're blind to the problem. And he says that's what happens with money. Money blinds you to the fact that you have a problem with money. That's the first thing you can't see that you're blind to. And that's true, isn't it? And, with an addiction, how do addictions work? You're blind. But the way that you get into the trap with an addiction is has to do with your tolerance level. You might drink one beer and get a buzz, but a month later or something, you build a tolerance. And you know, you now have to drink six beers to get the effect of the one beer. And that's the way it traps you, this lowering of tolerance so that you need more to achieve the same effect. And that's what happens with money. And that's why you're blind to it. I mean, again, in the beginning, I mean, I talked about it this morning. When I was 17, I had an old car, my own room, an original Nintendo, and a girlfriend, and I was happy. That's not quite enough anymore, though. I'm not. I need more than the Nintendo now. I was happy with what I had then, but that's not enough for me now. And you know, money blinds you even to the fact that you have luxuries. Remember in Luke chapter 16 where you have the rich man and Lazarus, and the angel is talking, or is it Moses? I cannot recall. But the rich man is being told, he said, now Lazarus didn't have anything in the earth, but you were surrounded by luxuries. You were surrounded by luxuries. You know what a luxury is? It's something that's not necessary to maintain life. That's what a luxury is. It's something that you can live without. It's not necessary to maintaining your life. If it's necessary to maintaining your existence, it's a need. I've got to have it. Without it, I might die. But a luxury is something that you have that if you didn't have it, you could live. So the things you need are air and water and food and maybe clothing, housing. Those are needs. But how many of us are surrounded? We live, we're like the rich man. We are surrounded by luxuries. Do you need all those doodads in your kitchen? I mean, how many ceramic chickens do you need in your house? I mean, you can clear out all your ceramic bunnies and ducks and chickens. You don't need those to live. They're a luxury. You know, you don't have to hunt to live anymore. See, your guns, it's a luxury to have all those guns. You really might, if you lived in the middle of nowhere, you might need one gun, but you don't need 30. See, you don't need them. You don't need them. They're a luxury. You don't need them to exist. How many chairs do we need in a house? I would hate to count how many chairs I have in my house. The point is that they're a luxury, right? They're a luxury. You really, indoor plumbing and lighting is sort of a luxury. People have lived without those things for over 5,000 years. People still live without those things. Those are luxuries. But see, we're like the rich man. We live and we are surrounded. Man, you know, in my family, we got to have yard sales. Here's a truth. My car, I can't keep it clean because I can't get it in the garage. And the cat, he must have a guilty conscience because every time I go out, he has slept on the hood, the top, and the back with dirty paw prints. But the reason I can't get my car in the garage is we've been working on a yard sale or a garage sale for 6 weeks, and the garage is still full of junk we can't get rid of. Now, the reason the garage, there's nothing in that garage that is necessary. It's all luxury. That's why we're getting rid of it. We don't need it. But we can live surrounded by luxury. Surrounded by things we don't need and say, well, I'm not rich. And because, you know, when we hear luxury, we think that's an $80,000 car. It's like, I don't drive an $80,000 car. I don't have luxury. No, you're surrounded. You are tripping in the night over stuff you don't need. You have that much luxury in your life. But we read that parable, Luke 16, and so we say, what an awful man. The Bible says he was surrounded by luxury and wouldn't help that poor man. What are you surrounded by? Why aren't you helping the poor? Guys, it's deceptive, see. The thing about it is, you need more to achieve the same effect, and you look around, and others have a lot more than you, but you don't see what you have. It blinds you to what you have. It's the effect of money. It also blinds you to the value of people. James in James chapter 2 says that the temptation is, as a church, and he's talking to that church, he says, if a man comes in with fine garments and he has stature in the community, you will give him the best chair, and if a poor person comes in with poor clothing, you'll have them sit in the back. He said, the problem with money is that you judge people based on money. It blinds you to the value of people. And if you think about it, that's often true. Even in our culture, we can look at a man and everything that's important in life, he's rich in. He's loved by his wife because he's a good father. He has succeeded. He succeeded as a husband. He's a good husband. And so he's a success when it comes to marriage. He is loved by his children. He is a success when it comes to parenting. He is a success when it comes to being a good friend. He's got lots of friends because he's a good friend. He's there when they have needs. He's truthful with them. He gives his time to the church. In every area that is really important, he's a success. But he stocks shelves in some place, and he drives an old beat-up truck maybe, and you know, he doesn't wear new clothes, and his shoes are always a little ragged. And society will look at him and say he's a failure. When in every area that matters, he's a success. But he's not financially successful, so they look at him and say, well, he hadn't done so well in life. No, he's done great in life in everything that matters. Everything of an eternal value, he's a success in. But he's not a success in making money. And so he's a failure. You take another guy, and he's on his fourth marriage. He's got six kids between four wives, and he doesn't spend a nickel's worth of time on any of them. Sends them great Christmas presents because he's got money, but he's a failure in marriage. He's a failure with his kids. He's a failure as a friend, but he's a self-made man. He's worth millions. The culture will look at him and say, boy, what a success. No, he's a failure at everything that matters in life, and he's a success at the one thing that he can't take with him, and he can't tell the difference. He has thrown away everything that matters for the one thing that actually doesn't matter in the end. But we look at him and say, boy, he's a great success. Look at what he's done. Look at what he's built. Look at the house he lives in. Isn't he great? And that's the thing that money will do to you. It will blind you to the value of human beings. It blinds you to who's successful or not. It can blind you in your judgment of people, but it can also even blind you in your judgment of yourself. Here's the thing. If you succeed in life, it's sometimes hard. Now, this isn't always the case. But sometimes it's very hard to not become a person with a sense of entitlement. You can feel yourself to be very important if you've succeeded in life. And I think the reason is, if you're in a place of management, your opinion counts. I mean, you're the manager, or you're the boss, or for whatever reason, your opinion really does matter. And maybe you eat at restaurants that are you're used to good customer service. I mean, if you don't have any money, you eat down at the place, and you get called honey by the waitress. You know, I don't know. You know, you're just happy the fork's clean. You know, that's, I mean, you don't worry about customer service. You don't expect customer service. I mean, good fork, you know, if they call you honey, if they get it there on time, that's fine. You don't expect great service. But if you have enough money, you might end up eating at places where, you know, they pull the napkin out for you and they put it on your lap and they make sure you're just used to stuff. Just used to stuff. And what happens is that creates a system of entitlement sometimes. Sometimes you think your opinion matters on things you don't know anything about. Your opinion always matters. People always think, and you end up getting mad about things other people don't get mad at. You end up saying, well, I guess my opinion doesn't matter anymore. I mean, that's because your opinion matters. That's because you're affluent. That's because you're somebody important. And so you expect everybody to say, well, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? And you end up with this somewhat bloated sense of self-importance on even things that you, again, know nothing about. I was my sister and her husband were in town today, and so we went hiking yesterday, and we're just talking about our life, and I think you're more tempted to do this, by the way, if you have a big education than even if you have a big bank account. But she's talking, and she works in a hospital. She's a surge tech, so she's the gal sitting there handing the instruments to the surgeon. And on her hall, they have a lot of political discussions, and the vast majority in her workplace are on one political persuasion, and then there's a small minority on another political persuasion. But she said a couple weeks ago there was a surge tech who was talking to a doctor about politics, and he finally just cut her off and said, honey, you don't know what you're talking about. You have a 2-year degree, and I was in school for 14 years. And if you went to school for 14 years, you'd probably see it right. Now, he went to school for 14 years to be a medical doctor. That doesn't mean he's an expert in politics. Doesn't mean he's an expert in politics, but he thinks he is. Thinks he is. Why? Because he got a degree. I mean, it's amazing to watch celebrities be interviewed, and they think they're experts at everything under the sun. They don't know anything. They're good at acting, and they're not really very good at acting. And who made them experts on religion and politics and philosophy? But see, success can do that to you. If you succeed financially, if you succeed in education, you end up thinking you know things that you don't know. It blinds you to your own limitations. Money has a way of doing that. Success has a way of doing that. So it can. First thing it blinds you to is how much you actually have because it's addictive. It also blinds you in your judgment of people, and you're not able to see things as they really are. And money has the power to do those kinds of things. It also blinds you, thirdly, and I'll move on because you talk about this a lot. It also blinds you to your security or your insecurity. There's just something naturally that comes with money that makes you feel insulated. It just does. Money's like insulation in your life. You just feel like I'm better able to tackle the problems in life if I have financial resources. And maybe to some degree you are. I mean, if you had the right financial resources, maybe you can get access to doctors, maybe you get access to legal care. I guess you can't open doors with money. But again, there's a sense in which it creates a false security. Because the things that are really important, money doesn't insulate you from. Having money doesn't make your marriage any more secure. It probably makes it less secure. Having money doesn't mean that your kids are more likely to stay off drugs. Doesn't mean it might mean that your kids are more likely to get on drugs because to make the money, you're not spending the time with them that you should. Having money doesn't prevent you from dying early, like anybody else would. Remember, that's what Solomon was so. One of his issues in Ecclesiastes, he said, "I got all this money, and I die like a poor man." It really really doesn't help, you know. And I this is a strange confession. I remember in 2011 when Steve Jobs, who was the CEO of Apple, I remember when he got pancreatic cancer. And I just thought, well, he'll live because he's Steve Jobs. I know he's got pancreatic cancer, and that usually takes a life, but, you know, he's a technological genius, and he's worth billions of dollars. With that much money and that much smarts, he'll live. Of course, he didn't. He died at the age of 50. His money didn't help him with that disease. So money doesn't help make your marriage more secure. It doesn't mean that your kids are more likely to avoid the pitfalls of everybody else. It doesn't mean that you're going to live any better or live in one sense any healthier. And those are the important things. And money doesn't help you with them. There was a quote here, and I wanted to get it right. But there was a professor named Addison Leach. And Addison Leach was married to a woman, the second husband of a woman, named Elizabeth Elliot. And anyway, he was a professor, and there were two girls in his class. He's a Bible professor, and these two girls were inspired to become missionaries by listening to him teach. So they go home and they tell their parents, "Hey, we want to become missionaries." And the parents said, "Oh no, that's a really bad idea. You can't go off and become, you can't drop out of school and become missionaries. You need to go and you need to finish your master's degree, and then you need to start some careers that provide you a nice income, and then you can start going on mission trips for like 2 weeks at a time or something. But you just can't drop out of school and go be missionaries." And they were disappointed, so they went back to the professor, Addison Leach, and said, "Our parents don't want us to go be missionaries. Why should we tell them?" And as Addison Leach said, "You need to tell them this." He said, "Tell them we're on a little ball of rock spinning through space called Earth. And who knows if we're going to run into something. And even if we don't, someday each one of us is going to open a trap door. Under each one of us is going to open a trap door, and everybody is going to fall off. At the end of your life, a trapdoor opens up underneath you, and you fall off this little ball of rock. Underneath will either be the everlasting arms of God or nothing at all. And you think a master's degree is going to give you some kind of security from that?" Now think about that. What's he saying? You're going to die. This little ball of earth. Things can happen. Sooner or later, you're going to die. And all of your education and anything you acquire isn't going to help you a lick in what matters most, and that is when you stand before the judgment seat of Christ. But again, money can make you feel secure. Money is a blinding force. It blinds you. He said, it pollutes your eye so that you look around and you feel far more secure than you should. You don't judge people as you should. You don't see people as they are because money keeps getting in the way of how you judge them. You can't even judge how successful you are because money hides what you have. And he's saying, that's the power of money. It pollutes your heart. Because money tends to draw your heart away from God, but it also pollutes your eye. You can't even see things as they really are. He finishes up and he says, you're going to have to decide who you're going to serve. He says, you can serve God or you can serve mammon. You can love God or you can love money, but ultimately you're going to have to decide which one you love because you can't love both at the same time. Now, he said, you'll love one and you'll hate the other. And I think what he's driving at here is, actually, you'll love one and you'll use the other. You're either going to love God and use money, or you're going to love money and you're going to use God. And I think that's the point. You're going to love one or you're going to hate the other. I mean, take a man, this is a terrible illustration, but take a man who likes two women, and he wants to think he loves them both equally, and he's not in Utah, so he can't marry them both. You either marry one and the other one will be a mistress, or vice versa. And the one who's a mistress, he'll use. He'll either marry one and use the other, or he'll use the other and marry the other. But you can't love them both. You know, when you're hiring people, particularly part-time, you got to be real careful when you hire part-timers. Because if they got a full-time job, the full-time job tends to get their priority, and they'll use your job for their savings, and if they can get enough saved, they'll quit you. But they're going to use you, and they're going to serve the full-time job sometimes. It doesn't always happen that way. But if you've got two employers, one gets a priority. One, you're going to answer the phone at 3 a.m., and the other one you're just going to use, and if they fire you, they fire you. But you're going to use that job. And what Jesus is saying here is you're going to love one and hate the other. You're going to be married to one. You're going to be loyal to one, and you'll use the other. And so what he's saying then is that for the Christian, I think, the Christian is called to love God and use money. And the way that you know you're loving God and using money is that money becomes just money to you. It's money, but it's just money. It's got no eternal value to me. If I have it, it's not where I get my sense of self-worth. I'm not smarter because I have it. I don't boast because I have it. I don't drive down the road and feel better than feel like I'm superior to other people because I have it. Money is just money. It doesn't matter to my sense of self-worth. It doesn't matter to my sense of security. I don't trust my money. I could die at any time, and I need to be ready to die at any time. I need to give my time to my children. I need to be a good husband. I need to be a good wife. It's not my security. It doesn't mean anything. It's not an end in itself. I mean, there's nothing I'm doing in life which it's with the main goal to make money. It's a means to an end to get somewhere, but it's never the end in my life. Money is just money, and that's all it is. It's just money. And I'll use it to get other things. But it's just money in the end. There's a place in the Quran that says something to the effect of this. It says, when a person dies on earth, we ask, how much did they leave? And at the same time, the angels are asking in heaven, how much did they send? And Jesus says that somewhere. He says, you need to take your money and you need to transfer it into eternal things. Use your money. Be generous with money. It's not an end. Use it. It's just money. And turn it into help people. Promote the gospel. Give a little to your kids. Yeah, save up for your kids. But turn it into something that is of eternal value. And that's seeing people brought to Christ with it. That's why I don't want to drive it home, but one of the ways you know you're not greedy is tithe. One of the ways you know you're not greedy is 90% is good enough. 90% is good enough. It's just money. It's just money. The meaning of it's just money. In fact, I give away more than 10%. It's just money. Just money. I'll say this in closing, like 2 minutes. I think the reason that Jesus talked so much about money is that he was talking to conservative people mainly. The problem with conservative people, and I'm not talking necessarily in politics here, the problem with conservative people is that we don't like it when people talk about our money in general. It's funny, in Luke 16:14, Jesus talks about the Pharisees. Luke mentions it. I don't think it's red letter. He says, but the Pharisees were lovers of money. And the Pharisees were the most conservative people in Israel in that day. It's funny, he said, the conservative Pharisees, they love money. What's interesting is that, and this is a very generalization here, but in general, liberals don't like it when you talk about what they do with their body. Liberals tend to say, don't talk to me about what I do with my body. I can sleep with whoever I want to sleep with. If I want to have an abortion, I'll have an abortion. It's my body. I can dress it any way I want. I can put anything on it. I can smoke, drink. I can do whatever I want to do with my body. It's my body. Don't tell me what to do with my body. That tends to be what the liberals or a liberal person would say. What conservatives will say generally is, don't tell me what to do with my money. I tithe 10%, don't tell me what to do with my money. If I want to buy stuff, I'm going to buy stuff. I tithe 10%. I give 10%, and that means I can do whatever I want with the other. If I want to buy stuff, I'll buy stuff. If I want to spend stuff, I'll spend stuff. If I want to go buy more, I'll go buy more. If I want to vacation out the wazoo, I'll vacation out the wazoo. But don't tell me what to do with the other 90%. It's mine. Don't tell me what to do with it. And they say the same thing about money that liberals say about their body. But the Lord wants complete control of your body, and He wants complete control of your pocketbook too. It's His. You are a steward. I am a steward. If He tells you to give it, give it. If he tells you not to fall in love with it, don't fall in love with it. He gets to tell you not just what to do with the 10%, but the 90% too. He's Lord of it all. I just throw that in because as a conservative, and I'm not talking particularly politics, I'm talking about probably more even theologically conservative. We resist these messages like liberal-minded people resist it when you talk about what to do with the body. And we put up walls there. But again, He's the Lord of the body. He's the Lord of the pocketbook. He's the Lord of the complete body. He's the Lord of the complete pocketbook. Amen. Everybody depressed? Everybody sad? You're going home to your luxuries. I hope you see them as luxuries. I hope you start throwing away doodads. You don't need all the ceramic ducks and the chickens. Get rid of it all. But he said, get it anyway. All right, stand with me if you will.